This is the Classic Auto Mall Show. Broadcast from the studios inside the Classic Auto Mall in Morgantown, Pennsylvania. Just 1 hour west of Philadelphia at Pennsylvania Turnpike Exit 298. Featuring nearly 1,000 classic, vintage, and barn-find vehicles for sale under one climate-controlled roof. Now, here's your host, Classic Auto Mall President, and the man with all the toys, Stuart Howden.
Is this really show number 158? I can't believe it. It's hard to believe that we've done 158 shows. And if Steve was sitting right here, he'd be equally impressed. But he's actually working today because JR, our engineer, is... Where is JR today? He's gone.
On vacation.
That, no, they don't allow that. There can't be any vacation.
Little vacation.
Judging from what's going on in that control room, I think he hope he enjoys his time.
He might need a vacation, is what you're saying.
Holy cow.
Great show today. We've got a wonderful guest on that we'll get to right here in just a minute. Just wanted to tell real quickly last week where we sold cars.
Okay.
How about Rockford, Illinois? Reespertown, I don't even know what that is. Reesperstown, Maryland. Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Brielle, New Jersey. Red Lion, Pennsylvania. Auburn, Pennsylvania. Georgetown, Delaware. Media, Pennsylvania. Fenton, Missouri. Chesterbrook, Pennsylvania. Lancaster, California. Mays Landing, New Jersey. Meshopin, Pennsylvania. Rockwall, Texas. Hamburg, Pennsylvania, Manitoba, Canada, Aerte, France. I don't know how to say
Wow.
Downingtown, Pennsylvania, Hamburg, Pennsylvania, Wallkill, New York, and Houston, Texas.
Where was it, California?
Lancaster.
Oh, Lancaster. Lancaster.
Lancaster.
Lancaster, California.
Lancaster.
That's right.
When it's here in Pennsylvania, that's where they right. like to say, they correct you when you say that.
They sure do.
So, anyway, now we'll get to the show. Instead of our jabbering. We're welcoming to the show today race car driver, commentator, car dealer, and actor, Mr. David Hobbs. Good morning, Mr. Hobbs.
Good morning to you, too. How are you?
Well, we're doing pretty good. I'm glad to have you on. And our friend Judy Stropas makes all these wonderful connections for all of us, and we couldn't thank her enough.
No, she's I've known Judy now for going on for 55 years, and she's just an incredible woman in motor racing.
She really is.
Better as a timekeeper when she worked for the Roger Penske organization. I was driving the Ferrari 512 at Daytona in the 24 hour, and she did all the timing and scoring for the whole field. And very often at the end of long distance races, the organizers, like the SCCA or whoever was sanctioning the event, they would come if there was any controversy amongst the team. They would usually end up, you know, they'd say to the SCCA, well, you got that wrong. We're actually a lap ahead of where you said we were.
Wow, that they'd could have happened.
They'd get the answer.
Yeah, that's, you know, I never thought of that, that they had to rely on her as heavily as anything to make sure that it was how many laps they've done and all that. You didn't know how many you'd gone in your head, right?
Oh, no, good Lord. No. you think you're going to count, but you soon lose count. And but, I mean, the fact was that she was... incredible. She could do the whole 24 hours without moving to the same spot.
Wow.
And she could obviously time our car and do our lap.
Sure.
But she would do a lap chart for practically the whole field.
Yeah.
And time a number of the cars, not just us.
Right.
So she was pretty incredible.
So you raced professionally for over 30 years, right? I mean, 31
I
years,
did.
I think. And you,
yeah.
I mean, there's not many that you didn't, sanctioned bodies you didn't race in. NASCAR, Formula One, sports cars, IMSA Camel GT, Indy 500, Formula 500, Trans Am, Can-Am, NASCAR. Holy moly. What about IndyCar? No IndyCar?
Oh, I did the Indy 500 a few times.
Well, of course.
Yeah. I did one. I did two NASCAR races, the Daytona 500. Daytona 500 in 1976.
Right. Was there some rubbing?
Well, I was driving a guy called for Benny Parsons.
Right.
Because Benny Parsons drove with me in a BMW in the 24-hour race, I got some Coca-Cola sponsorship, and as a quid pro quo, as they say, I shared that. Sponsorship with Benny for the 500, so I drove his backup car.
Nice.
Which actually turned out to be not much of a car, unfortunately. But,
right.
But in the qualifying race on Thursday, I finished eighth.
Wow.
Which put me on the eighth row, so I'm sort of right in the middle of the pack.
Yeah.
And you know, in those days, four speed, and you know, you go past the start finish line, they wave the flag, and off you go. Well, because they had very long gears, only four of them.
Right.
So, you know, the big round. But, you know, by the time you got around to turn three and four, you were almost up to top speed, which in those days was probably 180.
Right.
As I came off turn four for the first time, I'm right in the middle of this jostling pack of cars, and there's smoke and there's dust, and you can smell tire smoke and you can smell paint where people are rubbing down the wall and rubbing into you. And I'm looking in the mirror, and there's a whole phalanx of cars behind me. And you turn into the sun, and all there is dust, smoke. And I thought, not sure this was just a good idea after all.
This doesn't seem like a lot of fun.
That was my one and only Daytona 500.
That's funny.
24-hour race a lot of time.
Sure. How did Benny do in the BMW? That must have been foreign to him, literally.
Well, it was. He was not very good at the downshifting, but other than that, he was fine.
Sure.
He wasn't very up with heeling and towing, you know, because I think he wore cowboy boots to start, which didn't help.
And a cigarette dangling out of his mouth, probably, right?
but I mean, unfortunately, we came 10th because it was the year of the water in the fuel. And everybody, you know, we were red flagged for hours while the organizers sorted out the fuel and took all the water out of the fuel because we all got fed from the same source.
Sure.
But it seemed to affect our car more than the others. And I got stuck out on the track for about half an hour at one stage. And I walked back to pits, got some stuff. And anyway, we ended up being 10th. But,
right.
But he enjoyed the experience.
Sure.
And very much.
I mean, this is going to sound, is racing racing? I mean, can you, if you can race in something, can you race in everything? I mean, open wheel versus, you know, it seems.
We used to.
Right.
I mean, people like Mario. Yeah, you know, won the Indy 500, won the Daytona 500,
right,
and won the World Championship for Formula One cars. So in those days, you more or less had to, because unlike Adrian Newey, the designer, is about to get paid £35 million a year by Aston Martin, and people like Verstappen and Hamilton have been making $25 to $50 million a year for 10 years.
Yeah.
In those days, you had to drive as many cars as you possibly could.
Sure.
Because nobody would give you a big contract.
So, right.
But, I mean, Mario was probably, and Jimmy Clark, I mean, he won the World Championship twice. He won the Indy 500.
Right.
He won at Rockingham in an Indy car.
Oh, in an Indy car at Rockingham. Wow.
He won, not Rock, I'm sorry, the Milwaukee Mile. He won the Milwaukee Mile in an Indy car.
Indy car, yeah.
He won the British Saloon Car Championship in the Lotus Cortina. so we all drove all sorts of stuff in those days.
Did you have, I mean, if you had your preference, was it Formula One was the top of the heap or no?
Well, I never did much Formula One, unfortunately. I could never get my feet really into a proper team. Now looking back on it, probably a good job I didn't, because half the people that did Formula One when I was trying to do Formula One got killed.
Right.
So
it was very dangerous.
Probably best I didn't do it. Really,
yeah, not a bad.
I did do Formula 5000 extensively over here and won the championship in 1971. And they were like an Indy car or Formula car. They had a 5-liter stock block engine.
Sure.
And they were a cheap sort of Formula One car, but they were, in their day, they were as quick as the Formula One cars were.
Sure.
So it was a good formula. And there's something about single seaters that you have a feeling of oneness with the car, which you don't get in any other form of racing, really.
Well, and you're sitting in the center of the car, which is the road-going McLaren that they made sit in the center. That's an odd feeling if you're not used to sitting in the center, right?
Well, it certainly is on the road. It must be very odd, yeah.
Well, yeah, passing is difficult.
But in a Formula One car, you know, the wheels, your front wheels are just right there in front of you, so you know exactly where you are, and you really feel like you are part of the car.
Sure, sure.
But, of course, all these modern-day sports cars, like the Le Mans prototypes, they pretty much have a center seat. I mean, they're supposed to be two-seaters according to the rules and regulations, but it's all a bit vague, and they really are single-seaters with a lot of bodywork on them.
Sure.
When I drove sports cars, there was a lot of car around, like Can-Am cars. There's a lot of car around.
Sure. Did you love Can-Am? Was it amazing? Was it as cool as it looks?
Well, yeah, I like the Formula 5000 better in lots of ways.
Right.
They're almost as quick as the Can-Am. Of course, the Can-Am had the big 7-liter engine. So you know, they had a couple of hundred more horsepower.
Right, right. Did you drive
any... All that body work gave you a bit of downforce, too.
Sure, sure. Especially the 917s and the...
Well, right.
What did you race? Was it 917s that you raced at Can-Am?
Well, no, I raced a lot. I raced the factory loader in 1971.
Right.
Two, which was a pretty horrible car.
Right.
I raced an ex-McLaren team car in 1973 for Roy Woods, and that was one of the best cars I've ever driven. It was an amazing car.
Wow.
It was very sensitive. You could change roll bars, spring, just a little bit, and get an immediate feeling of either improvement or not.
Sure.
And it was easy to set up. And I could see then why McLaren had won so many Can-Am championships.
Sure.
Because their cars were extraordinary.
Well, and preparation is always key to racing. And then you raced with Roger Penske, who probably is the ultimate guy in preparation when it comes to that, right?
He was. And it was the most frustrating season I ever had, in a way, because
wow.
We drove Ferrari 512. Which Roger had rebuilt. It was an open car originally. They put a roof on it and turned it into a 512M.
Right.
And it was so beautifully done. It was quite amazing. And he had his engine man, Al Bartz, who really was a Chevrolet specialist out in California. He rebuilt all the engines when they came from Ferrari. They went straight to Al, who took them down every last nut and bolt and rebuilt them. And they were bulletproof. But in the Daytona 24 hour, Mark was on the pole. And we led, beating the factory 917s, which was good for our ego.
Yeah.
And we were doing extremely well. And right in the middle of the night, Vic Elford in his 917 had a tire blowout going through NASCAR 3 and caused a hell of a dust storm as he slid down off the banking. And Mark, obviously, with everybody else, slowed down, except some dork in a Porsche 911 that we had lapped about 1,000 times, ran into Mark.
Oh, geez.
And in those days, of course, there was only two drivers. Nowadays, they have three or sometimes
four. Yeah.
So in those days, you know, we had a little caravan to sleep in, and I was in there, and the caravan rocks, and in walked Mark, and I'm still half asleep, and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Yeah, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be out there."
Right.
And I got, anyway, we put about 10,000 yards of duct tape on it, and we still came third.
God bless duct tape, right?
Exactly. And we went to Sebring, we were on the pole, and we led. Then he had some sort of altercation with Pedro Rodriguez in one of the factory 917.
Right.
Out at the far back of the track. And Mark said he came in. I said that Rodriguez ran into me twice, and he was all very peeved. But I have since heard from a photographer who was there that it's not quite what happened.
Right.
It wasn't quite as Mark described it.
Mark was a little more aggressive.
Two out of two. Then we went to Le Mans, and we didn't have a long tail like the 917.
Right.
We had a small rear wing. We qualified third, and we were running very, very strongly. But on the Friday, which is your day of preparation, Roger Penske, the captain, rolls up and says, "Ferrari are going to give us a brand new engine. They're going to give us a brand new engine." So Mark, Woody Woodard, the chief mechanic, Don Cox, the chief engineer, they all said, no, we're absolutely, what we've got is just fine. It's perfect. It's running well. We're running well. Don't rock the boat. No, got the new engine. So we put the new engine in and lent our engine to another team. And our engine blew up at about 8 o'clock at night.
Oh, my goodness.
And the other car came third. and I think, and then our final race was the Watkins Glen 6 hour.
Sure.
And we were again on the pole, and which was very unusual. I mean, what was unusual was that the steering post broke. Which was very un-Roger Penske-like.
Right.
But, of course, Mark was one of those sort of guys that rarely ever crashed or made mistakes, and yet got caught out twice in the first two races, got overruled at race 3 with Le Mans, and we ended up not winning anything. And I couldn't believe I've been driving the great Roger Penske in the absolutely the best car. And we failed to win anything.
Isn't that interesting, though? But I think that happens maybe more often than people realize when it comes. Yeah. You have the perfect storm, but maybe it's not for whatever reason. And
I mean, you know, everybody says, well, the best car wins, and the best car does win normally. But we just ran out of luck four times. So it was all very unfortunate. But luckily, I did go on that year to win the Formula 5000 championship for Carl Hogan.
Right.
That made up for it. But and I did the Indy 500 for Roger that year.
Right.
And that was the first year of the McLaren winged car.
Oh, I remember those, yeah.
The M16. And Roger had one for Mark. And I drove Mark's Lola from the year before. And I qualified at about the same speed as Mark had the year before. But Mark and the two vacuum McLaren were miles ahead every day of the week.
Right.
Because in those days, you know, we got to Indy at the end of April.
Right. Yeah, you lived there for a month.
Today. Right? And we got there at the end of April, and we're out on the, we did about 2,500 miles.
Wow.
Around the track.
Wow, that's some prep.
And again, for some extraordinary reason, and Mark was quickest practically every day, quicker than the factory cars.
Sure.
Until qualifying, when Peter Revson just pipped. We sent Mark into a black rage. But then when the race started, Mark sort of disappeared down the road. But for some unmost Penske reason, they had drilled the big gear, because that was a Hewland LG gearbox, which was a huge thing. It weighed a ton. Gears were like bloody steam engine wheels from the 18th century, 19th century. Anyway, they drilled these gears for lightness for the race, and they hadn't done that at all. And of course, both gearboxes broke.
Well, they just weren't, they weren't set up for that, right? They weren't built for that.
No, and look, the gears broke. And when mine broke, coming off turn four, there was a guy behind me called Rick Muther, and he was right behind me. And in those days, you didn't have that lovely entry you've got now, that long entry as you turn off between three and four. You turned, there was a little slot in the wall, in the pit wall, which you went through. And I'd gone past that. It was this awful clatter and banging, and I thought the engine had gone, but of course the gearbox had broken.
Right.
So I'm freewheeling down the main straight, looking in the mirror, thinking, where's old Rick Muther gone? Well, Rick had swerved to miss me, hit the inside wall, bounced off the wall and ran into me.
Oh.
So we both ended up sliding and spilling down the front straight. And then Mark's gearbox broke, and he left it, the car, between three and four up against the fence, which is what they used to do in those days.
Right.
They'd give a yellow flag for about a couple of laps, and on you go, you know.
Figure you know where it is.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, Mike Mosley bounced off the wall and spun across the road and ran into the park.
Oh.
Set them both on fire.
Oh my God.
So Roger, going from front row, I mean, Mark would have won it.
Right.
And I probably would have been fifth or sixth.
Right.
Probably been rookie of the year.
Would have been a good day. Yeah, it would have been a really good day.
Instead of which you have two broken cars. Well, Teddy Mayer, when Roger said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll replace Mark's car and I'll take one for Hobbo as well. And Teddy Mayer said, I'm not going to give you another. I'm not going to sell you another one because, you know, you're too much of a threat. So I'll replace the one that Mark got beat up in.
Right.
But I'm not going to give you another one. So I didn't do the Pocono race or the Ontario race because Mark said, obviously, the Lola is, you know, out of date. Had it.
Sure.
Even though the race in the end was actually won by Al Unser
in a Lola.
Lola.
Well, you know, sometimes the best laid intentions, right? You don't always know the right answer.
It was a Bell Meditech car, wasn't it? It was a, yeah, they call it something else, Johnny Lightning Special. But
oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Basically a Lola.
Yeah. Right. We're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be back with Mr. David Hobbs in just a couple of minutes on the Classic Auto Mall Show. We'll see you in a couple of minutes.
Ever since the first time you saw it, perhaps even as a child, you knew you wanted one. now, you're at a point in your life where you have the means to buy and keep one. Your significant other is even in agreement. But where and how can you find one? And trust you know as much as you can about it before the purchase. That's why there's ClassicAutoMall.com. 1,000 classic vehicles of almost every conceivable make, model, and year. All under one climate-controlled roof. You can visit and look to your heart's delight. Or do everything online from the comfort of your own home. Shipping nearly everywhere worldwide, Classic Auto Mall can make your dream come true. Visit the World Wide Web at ClassicAutoMall.com.
If you want to see exciting fish, insects, and reptiles, you'll want to visit the Classic Auto Mall. Where else can you see hornets, honeybees, super bees, living in peace and harmony with stingrays, barracudas, tiburon, which means sharks, cobras and vipers, as well as beetles. And we don't mean the band. So if you come to Classic Auto Mall, you can see everything there is to see for free, and we won't bug you.
We're back with the Classic Auto Mall show from the Classic Auto Mall studio. I feel like I'm losing control here today, but I have a wonderful new friend, David Hobbs, via Zoom with us today. Now, you had an acting career, I understand.
I did. Two films. I was in Stroker Ace.
Right.
And Chris Economaki and I went down to Charlotte Motor Speedway and did called The Finish. Of the race that in the film, Burt Reynolds goes across the line upside down.
Right.
And to help us, well, they asked me if I'd do it. They paid Peter, absolute Peter.
Sure.
And I went there with Chris, and we sat in the press room, and the camera was in the press room. And what they did to make it easy for us to look like we're watching the car, down by the window of the press room, they had a guy on a plank. And he walked across the plank. So we watched this guy as he walked across the plank.
That's brilliant.
That was film one. And the other one was Cars 2 for Pixar.
Yeah. How was that?
When I do, I play the voice of David Hobbscap.
Right.
Which was a green XKE. Very similar to the one I drove in 1962.
Wow.
And I was David Hobbscap. He was Daryl, whatever.
Right.
And our play-by-play was, big on CBS, big on football, really. But that was also, they sent me a script, and I just read the script.
Right.
And then flew out to San Francisco, the Pixar studio, which was over the water in the dodgy side of town. And I just did my piece, and John, the director, sat right in front of me, and I stood up the microphone and just read my piece. And he said, oh, a bit more emphasis on winning, or a bit less emphasis on that. And I mean, the whole thing was over in about 45 minutes. I got on the plane, went back to Milwaukee.
So, probably a bigger check than you got in some of your racing years, right?
Well, actually, that was pretty pathetic, but it was what they called them. It was the union fee.
Right. So, whatever the minimum they had to pay you, right?
Or so it was about $2,500.
Oh, well.
But I still get royalties today.
Mailbox money. You got to love mailbox money.
But it's not. I mean, I get about $100 every quarter.
Right. So it's not even a good.
It was 2013. So
yeah, that's not nothing, right? Isn't that funny?
It makes you think just how much these guys that do these things that go on forever.
Oh,
ever,
yeah.
Ever.
Like Seinfeld or who, by the way, is selling his 917 Porsche down at Mecum in January, I saw.
Is he?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. The highest price paid so far for a 917 is like $14
million. Is it?
Which is, you know, I remember when people had a hard time selling those cars. People didn't really care too much about them in the late 80s, or, you know, the 80s. They weren't thought about as collectible.
Didn't he buy that car from Richard Atwood?
I think it somehow had to do with Richard Atwood. Symbolic Motors was involved. The story was always that he bought it from a used car dealer, but Symbolic Motors is not really a used car dealer in the
Ryan Redmond was given that 917.
That's exactly right. That's right.
And he had it at his house in Yorkshire. Then he fell on slightly hard time because he broke his neck
at
a Can-Am car, which flipped over. And he broke his neck, and it cost him a tremendous amount of money in a hospital in Montreal for a week. And he got an offer from Carl Haas to come and work for Carl Haas, who he had driving for when he broke his neck.
Right.
In the Can-Am car. So he needs to move to America. And I think he sold that car to Richard for peanuts.
Right.
And then I think Richard sold it to, took it to Monterey.
Yeah.
And I think Seinfeld bought it. It was about $1 million.
Yeah, exactly.
And now it's 14, right?
Or more. I mean, I guess the estimate is 16 to 20. So, you know, give or take.
There's a car here. This week is a Ferrari here. Blue Ferrari, number 8. And it would be an early one, like a 1952, 51.
Right.
It was at Le Mans, and Frank Boucher, who's a local car dealer, paid $5 million for it.
Wow.
And he was saying that it's probably worth 10 now.
So, unbelievable. And Ferrari GTOs are 50 or 60 million.
Yeah, McNeil.
McNeil, yeah.
He's here. There's 300 Ferraris here, and he's got 26 of them.
10% almost.
Yeah.
Damn him.
Floor mats.
Yeah. Hey, those are some really good floor mats, right?
I agree.
And then the bumper step, and then he also makes a thing for protector for your dogs in the back seat that good stuff.
Good
so stuff. That begs the question, speaking of back seats and dogs and all that, what's your daily driver?
My daily driver is Bentley Continental GTC.
Ah, right on. See, most times I get... I'll say, oh, it's a minivan or, you know.
Well, up till then, it was a Honda CRV.
Well, those are great cars, right?
Yeah.
And that's how you pretend like it's cool that you own one. Yeah, oh, they're fantastic cars.
Yeah, well, they are a hell of a good car, actually.
I had a Honda CRX SI back in college, and I put 220,000 miles on that car, and it never gave me any trouble.
No.
And then when Honda came out with the NSX, you know, that was like the Honda of sports cars, which... wasn't necessarily complimentary, but it was complimentary because it was easy to drive and it was reliable as hell.
Yeah. And of course, people didn't like it originally because it was too reliable. I said, right. Well, it's got electric windows and they actually work. That's not right. You know?
Yeah. I had a friend of mine who had a GPS system in his car, apparently, and he was coming from Philadelphia. And I said, when will you be here? And he said, 15 minutes. And an hour later, he showed up and I said, what the hell happened to you? I said, do you have a Lucas GPS? He didn't.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was pretty clever. So,
Prince of Darkness.
Yes, the Prince of Darkness. Absolutely. Yeah. Hey, I saw a picture of you back in the day. I don't know what you call them. Were those mutton chop sideburns that you had? Those were badass.
Mutton chop and a mustache.
I'd like to see that come back. I think that was pretty cool looking.
I can't grow them now. They won't grow.
And
but if they do grow, that'd be great.
Yeah, well, hey, looky here.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's what you get. So you started broadcasting career with CBS, I guess, back in 79. Now, were you 76. There? 76. Oh, so you were there in 79 when the fisticuffs broke out in the at the Daytona 500, which was the best thing that ever happened to NASCAR probably at that time.
Oh, that was the best thing that happened to NASCAR ever.
Right.
Ken Swire had been badgering CBS for years. Forget about IndyCar. Forget about Formula One. NASCAR's where it's at.
Right.
Because nobody up in New York never heard of NASCAR. So eventually the vice president of sports comes down to watch the Daytona 500 in 76.
Right.
And they decided to give it a go in 79. And they were not looking. I mean, the Wall Street guys weren't looking for much real reaction to it. And by a stroke of luck, the Northeast was completely blanketed in snow. So there was no football, no nothing. And apparently, you know, 8 million people tuned in to watch it, which absolutely knocked the socks off CBS.
Right.
And, of course, it absolutely transformed NASCAR because it was the first time one had ever been shown live, flag to flag. Ken and I had done quite a bit of NASCAR racing, but it was all taped.
Right.
Which is awful stuff to work with, because it's all cut segments. And you've got to be just spot on when you come in and go out. So we used to do those in the middle of the night at the studio in New York.
No fun. Doesn't sound like fun at all.
Well, it wasn't, because nobody at CBS thought much of it. So they allotted us the absolute, you know, graveyard shift time. You couldn't use the studio, the sound studio, for anything like that in the day. So we hadn't done a few NASCAR races, but they were all chopped up.
Right.
That was the first live flag to flag.
Well,
and it absolutely made NASCAR, put NASCAR right on the map.
Well, I mean, those two brawling out there, I mean, that just, you know, that was just.
Talk about, and the guy who had been running a distant third was Richard Petty.
Right.
Who goes on to win about his 10th bloody Daytona 500.
It's crazy.
So the crowd got everything. They got a fight. They got a Richard Petty win.
Yeah. How amazing was that? And you know, yeah. NASCAR, I mean, listen, a lot of racing is like that. If you've never been to a real professional pro, you know, drag race, you'd have no idea how cool it is until you actually go there and you go,
yeah.
Oh my God, these things are the most powerful things I've ever seen in my entire life.
Staggering.
Yeah. We have Maple Grove is north of us about 7 miles. And this weekend is the NHRA is here in town, and it'll be, you know, these top fuel dragsters, we'll hear it 8 miles away at our house, like it's running down the street.
I suppose so. Yeah. Yeah. They got a lot of power.
Yeah, they got a little bit of power. Did you race at Le Mans 20 times? Is that correct?
I did.
Golly.
And I've got the record for doing it the most times without ever actually winning it.
Do you know the track by heart? Could you, in your mind, close your eyes and see the whole track?
Yeah,
I imagine.
Absolutely. I did it. The last one I did it with Damon Hill, who went on to become world champion. So I obviously taught him a lot that weekend.
And do you get 10% of his earnings, right?
I get 10% of his earnings. But it was the last race down the Mulsanne Strait, which used to be 4 miles, and now it's got a couple of chicanes in it because the town is spread out and there's supermarkets and garden centers and all that stuff out there. So,
what was it like driving the Mulsanne Strait? I mean, were you just like you were floating?
Well, it was all very well and good because we were doing in the 962s, we're doing about 240. And which didn't feel particularly fast until you suddenly came upon somebody who'd got a flat tire doing about 50.
Oh.
Then, you know, it was quick.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the worst, the really dangerous bit was when you went around the Mulsanne hairpin and went down towards the Indianapolis section.
Right.
It's as fast as the straight, but it's always on a slight curve. And there's a couple of dips in the road. And that was, in the dark, that was very tricky because you couldn't see over these dips.
Right.
So if there's any lying in the road, you wouldn't see it because it was way too late.
Way too late, yeah.
But I enjoyed Le Mans because you've got some wonderful corners. And you're averaging, like, your lap speeds around about 150 mile an hour.
Crazy.
With a couple of hairpins. So
yeah, that's pretty good.
It was a great track to drive.
Great average.
And, of course, the night was short because it's always the middle of June. So
sure.
You had a very long day and a short night.
Right. Which, very helpful, right.
As opposed to Daytona, the 24 hours.
Right. It's a long ass night.
Yeah.
When we return, we'll come back with segment three with you if you're still good with us, David. We'll return with the Classic Auto Mall show in just a couple of minutes.
The Classic Auto Mall is located not far from Audubon, Pennsylvania, named after James Audubon, the famous ornithologist. And there's probably no better place for bird watching. Look there, a flock of thunderbirds. Of course, who doesn't love the power for firebirds? Studebaker lark and hawks, Buick Skylarks, plus AMC Eagle, and the difficult-to-catch Roadrunner. Oh, there's no better place for bird watching than Classic Auto Mall.
This is the Classic Auto Mall Show. Listen on this station and wherever you get your podcasts, including Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Buzzsprout, Deezer, Listen Notes, Pandora, Player FM, Pocket Casts, Podcast Addict, Podcast Index, Podchaser, Spotify, and, of course, ClassicAutoMall.com.
And we're back with the Classic Auto Mall show from the Classic Auto Mall studio, Morgantown, Pennsylvania, talking to our friend David Hobbs and just talking about just all the fun things and Formula One today and watching McLaren do so well. And we were just talking about Oscar Piastri, who drives for McLaren. He's the coolest guy out there. I think that's got to be kind of, you can't be high strung and be a good race car driver. Maybe I'm wrong. Can you?
Well, I suppose not. You know, you don't see many high strung Formula One drivers, but I mean, I thought it was very telling in Hungary when Verstappen was not doing very well, how he just moaned and moaned and moaned and moaned to the crew about the car and wouldn't do this, it wouldn't do that. Hamilton does a bit of that from time to time, but Piastri and what gets me is when I used to drive, it didn't matter how many laps I did. I did more than about 10 laps. I'd get out, my hair would be soaking wet and I'd be perspiring.
Right.
These guys get out and they do a 2-hour Grand Prix and they get out and take the helmet off. The hair's perfectly, I mean, I don't get it. He's very cool. Piastri will go. I think he'll be a world champion one day.
I think so too. And you know, the interesting thing about Lewis, you mentioned Lewis, and he gripes on the radio, but at the end of the race, he's very complimentary of his fellow drivers and of his team. And, you know, he's in the moment, he's that way. And then he seems to get it. I mean, but driving a modern Formula One car, is that even like driving? Can you relate it to anything that's an automobile that they got to be crazy?
I mean, obviously everybody says, look at Fangio, the races were 3.5 hours long, which they were.
Right.
Great big steering wheel, bloody great big gear shift and skinny tires. The exhaust pipe ran down the side of the car like under your elbow.
Right.
And they were tough, physically tough to drive, and they slid around a tremendous amount. But these modern cars with all that grip and all that technology stuff, I mean, I couldn't drive a Formula One car. I can't even understand the steering wheel.
Right.
These guys are working all that. They changed the differential going into the corner and coming out of the corner. It's just weird. I mean, so they're doing a lot, and they're still going 180 mile an hour.
And they're getting talked to in their headphone right in the middle of I'll never forget, I think it was Lando this year said, I'm right in the middle of passing somebody. Can you just ease up a sec?
Yeah,
and then how about the 1.9 seconds pit stops? I mean, that's...
Oh, are they incredible?
It's amazing. It's like watching a ballet or something. I've never been to a ballet, so I don't even know that's true. But, I mean, it's really poetry in motion watching those guys work.
If there was a cop watching those pit stops, he would accuse them of doing a rolling stop.
Right. Exactly.
He would say, you guys never stop.
Or a California stop, we like to call it, too.
Yeah.
I get a few of those tickets every once in a while for whatever reason. I don't know why. It seems like they're just profiling me. I don't know. Gray-bearded guy with a, you know, in a Porsche. So this year you are going to be the Grand Marshal at the Chattanooga Motor Car Festival in Chattanooga, Tennessee, which is a fantastic event. I love that event.
I do, I went to the first one, which I thought was just fabulous. Brian Remmer was the guest of honor, which obviously put a bit of a damper on it, but I mean, he's pretty good, really. I missed the second one, but I've been to the last two, and it is one of the most fun festivals of the year, I think, downtown in Chattanooga.
Oh.
The only thing I've ever seen in Chattanooga is driving by on the freeway.
Sure.
And it always looks terrible from the freeway, all those closed down buildings.
Yeah.
But you get right downtown, and it's a super little town.
It's the hub. It's an amazing hub that they've built with that hotel there and the Ferraris on display in the parking lot and the restaurants.
Exactly.
And man, it's a lot of fun. And the great thing about it is it's affordable. If you can call, you know, $20 for a 3-day ticket to go see the Chattanooga Motor Car and see a lot of amazing cars. I mean, Bill Marriott's Ferraris are there and it's not nothing. And,
it's a very good event. I mean, it's one of the most fun events of the year, I think.
And I'm going to really miss watching Corky Coker and his banditos race those, pre-war speedsters around there.
And old Corky in that white overall. With his riding boots on.
If I wore riding boots like that, I would be thrown out of the country. I would look like an idiot.
You're not talking.
No, I had him on the show. Oh, he was fantastic. He's so funny. And just a down-to-earth, you know, you love down-to-earth people, you know.
Yeah.
It would be, I guess, the equivalent of a Cockney over in across the pond.
Yeah, something like that, exactly. We went to his museum the first year and had a reception there. And that's another eye-opening place. His museum.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and he's just one of those guys that you could never be jealous of a guy's success like that. He just is just a likable guy and deserved of everything that he's done, and the stories that he tells, and what he's done for the hobby. I mean, if it weren't for Coker tires, there'd be a lot of cars that I don't know what we'd be doing for tires right now.
Well, right, no, and because Byron DeFore and his brother who run it,
right?
They're a great couple. I mean, Byron raced. I don't think he's racing anymore, but he used to race the Can-Am car, and mm-hmm. They're really into cars and car culture, and they really enjoy it. They do. They put on a great show.
And I think it's one of those ones that'll be up there in the top 10 or so of car events, I think, for as long as they continue doing what they're doing. I absolutely.
That's a great judge.
And great judges, and there's some great judges in the hobby. We just had the Radnor Hunt Concours d'Elegance this past weekend here in Pennsylvania, and that's beautiful setting on a horse farm. You're 20 minutes from downtown Philly, but you feel like you're a million miles from there. You know, it's amazing.
I've never been to it, but
we'll have to get
I've heard
you there.
A lot about it.
We had Alan Cathcart, the motorcycle expert, rider, test driver, was here as the guest of honor this year. And, and he's a character. He was great. We had him on the show about 3 weeks ago, and some amazing British motorcycles, which are works of art in and of themselves. The engines alone are just amazing. So did you just recently, somebody did a book on you, and was that fun or was it painful?
No, it took me a long time to do it. It's an autobiography, but I wrote it in conjunction with Andrew Marriott.
Right.
Who I've known since I was about 17, I was about 19 when I started racing.
Wow.
And he went on to become a preeminent writer in motorsports writer. And he's written some books, and he did a lot of TV too. He worked with us at Speed Vision quite a bit.
Oh, right. I forgot about Speed Vision.
He always did the pit lane at Le Mans because he's fantastic, because he knew everybody.
Right.
And, he's amazing. He knows everybody. He remembers stuff, unlike me. He remembers stuff. So he was good to work with. And that came out quite a few years ago now, but I'm still selling a few.
Well, there you go. I love what Sam Posey said about you. He says, Penske liked you because you used common sense and always brought the car back in one piece. And BMW liked you because you could talk the same language as the engineers. You know, and not all drivers speak engineer, right? I mean, that's a valuable tool.
Well, I think it helped me quite a bit. I mean, I could always interpret what they were trying to tell us. Obviously, I think the absolute best duo have been actually the first duo was Jimmy Clark and Colin Chapman.
Right, with Lotus.
Jimmy Clark was a farmer, and he knew exactly what he felt in the car and could explain it to Colin. Colin knew exactly what to do about it. And of course, the next duo that came along really was Sebastian Vettel and Adrian Newey.
Yeah, that was a hell of a team.
And then, of course, Adrian Newey and Max Verstappen.
Yeah.
And Newey could tune those cars to suit those guys, which didn't help their teammates.
Right.
Because suddenly the car might have got difficult for them to drive.
Sure.
But it suited the team leader. And some of these guys have got this ability to interpret exactly what the driver says.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense, that saying it that way, that when the car gets tuned for one of them, it's probably not tuned for both of them.
Yeah.
They're all different, and their styles are different, and all of that.
Yeah, exactly.
So does knowing how to work on a car advantageous? I know that, there's a lot of drivers don't know how to work on cars, and some know can tear it down.
Well, I prefer not to. I mean, I used to do my own first couple of cars, raced my mum's Morris Oxford and dad's XK.
Right.
I did a bit of work on those, but a mechanic from Jaguar came over and helped me with the Jag.
Right.
But the Morris, pretty much I did all that, but I didn't enjoy it all that much, really. But I had enough technical knowledge to know exactly more or less what was going on, not everything, but, quite useful to have.
Sure. And so, one of the questions I always ask people is that, did you have who was your hero when you were growing up? Who were you watching and paying attention to?
Well, my first hero was, of course, Sterling.
Oh, yeah.
I think Sterling was, I mean, he's the guy that got closer to winning the world championship. And the, and one of the times he got so close, and he actually gave it up by going to the stewards when Mike Hawthorn, who was driving the Ferrari,
right,
had spun in Portugal in a street race and was nabbed for driving in the wrong direction to turn around. And Sterling, after the race, I'm not sure whether Sterling won it, but anyway, they had disqualified Hawthorn. And old Sterling goes up to stewards. I say, chaps, that was a bit harsh. I think, you know, really, he was actually just turning around.
Right.
So they reinstated his point, and he beat Sterling by 1 point for the world championship.
Oh my goodness! How devastating! So, but I guess it didn't. I mean, he was the you know, did the right thing. Nothing wrong with that, right?
Well, I don't think you'll find that Verstappen or Hamilton is going to be saying jumping to each other's assistants where they go wrong.
I think you're probably correct. Well, yeah. I can tell you that it's certainly been a delight having you on the show today, and we really appreciate your time. And I understand there's a lot going on Elkhart Lake this weekend with the Historics and the Ferrari Club, and
then the Vintage, then the Austin Healey Club next week, and then only a couple of weeks later it'll be October the 11th. Time to go to Chattanooga for the. The Motor Car Festival, which will be great.
Yeah, I'll look forward to seeing you there. I've already booked my room, so we'll get to meet in person and be glad to shake your hand and pat your back.
Okay, well, lovely to talk to you all today.
Take care, David. David Hobbs, everybody. Thanks for being on the show.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Are you bored with your commute? Listless in your lane, and you don't even have the get up and go on green? 9 out of 10 doctors recommend Classic Auto Mall to cure the common drive. The Classic Auto Mall in Morgantown, PA is a veritable classic car supermarket with classics of all prices, types, and years. So if you need a cure for the common drive, check out Classic Auto Mall in Morgantown or ClassicAutoMall.com. Side effects include not wanting to come home, going to car hop drive-ins, grease under your fingernails, old car smell, and bias. No matter what you think is a classic car, you'll probably find one at Classic Auto Mall. How about a two-owner 2003 Chevrolet Corvette Coupe with 5,105 actual miles? Like trucks? Maybe a 66 Chevrolet C10 Stepside with a 350 V8 and a TCI 700R4 automatic transmission, or a 1984 Chevy C10 short bed, chopped, shaved, louvered, and a nearly new 355 V8. How about true classics like a 1926 Pontiac Series 627-665. It's the first year Pontiac with multiple AACA awards. And let's not forget Mustangs, like a 67 hardtop, three owners, and a fully known history, or a 1998 Mustang Cobra convertible with 38,209 actual miles, one of just 343 built. So whatever floats your boat or opens your garage, with over 1,000 constantly changing vehicles, you'll probably find it at ClassicAutoMall.com.
About cool as David Hobbs.
We got some good guests.
We are really
Sir. Is it Sir David Hobbs?
I don't know.
Has he been knighted? I'm not sure.
Or knighted?
He might be knighted. He might be Sir David.
I don't know that I read that or not. I'm not sure.
Well, he should be.
God bless Judy Stropas. She has been so wonderful to us, and I'm going to see her tomorrow night at the dinner for Zach Brown in Watkins Glen, the Corning Museum of Glass in Corning, New York.
The racer, not the singer.
The racer, not the singer. Yeah, because this one's Z-A-K. And is the singer Z-A-K or is he Z-A-C?
It's Z-A-C.
Z-A-C. And Zach Brown, the race car team CEO of McLaren, is Z-A-K.
Okay.
Brown. So, just so we clear that out. And he's got a hell of a collection of race cars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, amazing collection of race cars. How about Radnor Hunt this past weekend?
Oh, wow.
I mean, first of all, the weather was spectacular. Second of all, it's just a fabulous event. If you've never been, I know we've talked about it a lot on the show because it's worthy of talking a lot about on the show.
And there are friends.
And we like, and I'm on the board.
Oh, yeah.
But
there's
full
that.
Full disclosure, and we're a sponsor. But other than that,
it was a perfect day.
From the heart. It is a wonderful event.
Yeah.
It is, as we jokingly say, 15 minutes from chaos in downtown Philly. And it's just beautiful. The horse, it's the Radnor Hunt horse facility, and it's just amazing. And it all started, as Mike Tilson said on the show 3 or 4 weeks ago, just a little garden party of cars.
Mm-hmm.
you know, here we had 100 amazing cars and some of the most amazing motorcycles you'll ever see.
Some of the rarest motorcycles.
The rarest of the rare. And then the best in show was a V16 Cadillac, which is
right
apropos. And what stood out to you? Did you?
Well, of course, the RSK 917, 1959, one of 34 RSKs.
You just walk around the corner and you go, what is that? That can't be.
Well, I'm like, that's a replica. Because I've been looking at them on Bring a Trailer, 550 replicas that you can buy.
Yeah.
And I go, oh, that's a nice
the
replica.
Beck? Are you looking at the Beck?
Yeah, the Beck and some of the other ones.
They're pretty cool. The Beck ones are pretty well done.
I've seen one in person in New Hope years ago, and it blew me away.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the most attention-getting car you'll ever have.
I had a friend of mine had one. It was a Beck Spider, but it had a Subaru engine.
Yeah, right.
Subaru. And it was fast.
That's what they put in them now.
Yeah. Why is that, I wonder?
The configuration of the Subaru boxer engine. A real RSK in person, I was blown away, and that stood out. And, I always love when the Porsche Club shows up with 40, different Porsches.
There's every ink and very 996, 997s, 930s, 920, whatever. And, of course, the Motorsports Park, which is down below a little bit, is a show in itself. And then the parking lot.
The parking lot was great. I missed the parking lot this year. You can kind of see it from our booth. Mm-hmm. And you can see some really cool cars out there.
God.
When they're leaving, you
McLaren
can see
McLaren Sennas and, just these fantastic cars that you don't just see driving down the road. Although, from time to time, you do. I mean, out in that part of the world.
For sure.
A lot of money out there. A
lot of collections. It's the beautiful rolling hills of Chester County. It's absolutely spectacular.
It really is. And they do a rally that is apparently just high on everybody's list of the most fun rallies you can possibly do.
I'm looking for the photograph. There's an Aston out there that looked a lot like yours.
But then
A Koenigsegg. There was a carbon fiber Koenigsegg. I don't know how many. It says one of 80 on the license plate.
Oh, right.
And that thing was insane.
That Aston Martin, it had the the Roadster Thunderbird, that fiberglass.
So the cowl hood or
cowl tied back on it that's over the back seat.
A fairing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's so cool looking. But I think it was at DBR9 Racing Green.
Yep.
Which I thought I had the only one. I was guaranteed the only one in Pennsylvania.
Oops.
But apparently I was lied to.
Beautiful stuff.
Yeah. Those people.
And let's again, shout out to the weather. I mean, they've had some really bad years where.
The past 3 years have been
flooding or rainy.
And they went 22 years without a drop of rain.
Wow.
And then all of a sudden, 3 years in a row, and this year was perfect.
Yep.
70 degrees, low humidity, great vendors. The Ferrari dealer was out, the Range Rover dealer. We had cars out there with our setup. It's just an amazing event. And they had the barbecue on Friday night and the gala on Saturday night, and that was a lot of fun. I met some great people.
Met
the guy who designed the ring for the Kansas City Chiefs Super Bowl ring for Jostens, and it's the one that flipped open, and it was actually the stadium inside
so
when
cool.
you flip it open.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And just a lot of you meet a lot of interesting people that are not famous in the sense of the word of being famous, but they're just people that are well known in the hobby that have interesting careers and jobs and run different things and. Meeting people involved with the Pebble Beach Concours that were there and all of that, and then some fantastic collectors. And it's all about the people. I mean, it's about the cars. Yeah, I get it. But to me, the people is equally as important because you meet some of the finest people that you'll ever meet.
It's fantastic.
And when you meet them in that environment, it's, if you tried to call up some of these guys and get an appointment with them to come meet them, you'd never get through. But you run into them on a level playing field when you're all out there admiring the cars and enjoying the beautiful day. It's much easier to talk to them and realize that you got a lot of common ground there.
Right. And sometimes you don't know who you're talking to.
Have no idea. And then they start raising their hand at an auction for $5 million Duesenberg. You're like, hey, dude, I'd like to get to know you a little better.
Yep.
Do you know what I have? I have 950 cars in Morgantown, Pennsylvania. So anyway, thanks for joining the show today. And show number 158. Is in the can, as they say.
That's right.
And we'll catch you next week with a guest to be determined. See you then.
You've been listening to the Classic Auto Mall Show with your host, Stuart Howden. Executive producer, Steve Saphir. Produced and engineered by yours truly, J.R. Russ.
Available on ClassicAutoMall.com, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Questions, answers, or comments? Write us at ClassicAutoMall.com. And if you want to talk about buying a classic car seen on our website, you're looking for a particular vehicle, or want to consign your classic for sale, write us at info@ClassicAutoMall.com or call and talk to a real live classic car specialist at 888-227-0914. That's 888-227-0914. Music courtesy of the Pat Travers Band. For tour dates, contact, and stuff, visit pattravers.com. Produced by Car Smarts Media. Copyright all rights reserved.
Classic Auto Mall is located not far from Audubon, Pennsylvania, named after James Audubon, the famous ornithologist. And there's probably no better place for bird watching. Look there, a flock of thunderbirds. Of course, who doesn't love the powerful firebirds? Studebaker lark and hawks, Buick skylarks, plus AMC eagle, and the difficult-to-catch roadrunner. Oh, there's no better place for bird watching than Classic Auto Mall.
You are invited on a safari at Classic Auto Mall on a search for animals. Look closely and you might see a tiger, jaguar, and a cheetah or cougar as they try to catch a herd of impalas. And don't forget the wild mustangs and broncos, plus gazelle, rabbits, and rams. Instead of the zoo, you'll want to do your animal watching at Classic Auto Mall. It smells better too.